Save big money in your next painting project now at Menards. From your kitchen and bath to doors and trim and even your ceilings, Dutch Boy has the perfect finish for your painting projects. Dutch Boy's DuraFighter is a tough paint and primer that provides great scrub resistance and durability. Save big on Dutch Boy paints. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and get your painting project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week, we bring you the best news, views, and interviews with the clinicians, founders, CEOs, and leaders in this space that are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As everyone who listens regularly will know, I am a CEO and founder of a health tech business myself called PocDoc. We are focused in the cardiovascular disease prevention space. And so if you're worried about your heart health, if you're worried about your cardiovascular health, if you're finding it difficult to get a health check done, then please head to pocdoc.co to learn more about our healthy heart check. So in 10 minutes, just using your phone, you can get a full cardiovascular screening delivered to you at home with results, complete results in 7 minutes. So please head across to pocdoc.co for more information. And thanks as ever for PocDoc for supporting the show. Now, today's show is a huge milestone. It is our 100th show. We are 100 shows old today. And for me personally, I want to just say a few things about it. I want to thank everyone who's listened and stuff, but we'll get to that. When I first came up with the idea of doing the show, every single person said to me that it was a terrible idea and it wouldn't work. And I decided that I wanted to carry on with it because I felt so passionately about providing a platform for all of the incredible clinicians and leaders and doctors and founders and CEOs and investors as well, who don't get enough credit for really investing their life in trying to make the world a better place. And, you know, 100 shows later, 9 million streams across the world later, we've got listeners in 60 different countries worldwide. We're on all of the major podcast and video channels, and we've had 100 separate shows with 100 separate guests. So thank you very much to everyone for listening. And thank you very much to UK Health Radio for giving us the live streaming platform, which has been hugely, hugely exciting for us. And thanks for all of the guests for coming on. It's really appreciated. So yes, onwards and upwards, here's to the next 100 shows. And for my 100th show, our 100th show, I can't think of a better guest than Daniel Nathrath, the CEO of Ada Health. Now, for those of you who don't know, Ada Health are now, by quite some distance, after developments in the space, they're quite some distance the leader in AI-powered telehealth and clinical decision-making. They're a unicorn, and they've proven time and time again the accuracy of their AI predictive models versus clinicians versus the standard pathways. And they've done incredible things all over the world. Daniel and I have actually known each other for a long time, and it's taken ages to get him on the show, but I'm really pleased that we've got him and to go through, you know, the journey from setting up this, because now today we talk about AI like it's everywhere. But when Ada was created, it was really very, very much a nascent new field. And so it's going to be an incredible journey, and I'm really looking forward to getting into it. So Daniel, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you, Steve. I'm great. Thank you for having me. And my apologies. I think I was meant to be one of the first 10, and now I just learned it's the 100th show. So I feel very honored to be here for your anniversary, and congrats it's on what you built.
Thank you.
Both with the show and also with PocDoc. Great job.
You. Thank you very much. So there's kind of so much I want to dig into with you, but where I'd like to start, if it's okay, is what was the original insight around beginning with ADA, and how did you come to that? Because obviously I know, I think lots of people listening will know of ADA, but many won't. And some will have interacted with ADA from like a personal patient perspective, but many won't. And so I think actually maybe like really the very, very initial kind of light bulb moment and how that happened.
Yeah, so I mean, the company was founded over 13 years ago. My co-founders are a German scientist who's now a medical professor for medical AI in Germany, and a British doctor, a pediatrician and geneticist, did a PhD in Cambridge. And the original idea really was to one of my co-founders, of the German professor, who's a great guy, Martin, he really wanted to support doctors at the point of care when making a diagnosis and thereby reduce misdiagnosis. So the original product that we built actually for the first few years was not geared towards patients. It was geared towards doctors. And as you can imagine, you mentioned, you know, we've been at it for a long time. At least in Germany, and partly probably even in the UK, 13 years ago, many doctors weren't quite ready to use software to help them make better diagnoses. Because, you know, I come from a doctor's family. You know, I love doctors, but a lot of them weren't exactly early adopters when it comes to tech.
Were they ready to admit that there may be some instances of misdiagnosis?
Even? Yeah, so that's interesting because it kind of, you know, maybe we'll get to that later, but it leads us kind of full circle. So my co-founder's idea in the beginning was to focus very much on rare diseases, which is something that we're now doing again more. So I think a lot of doctors, in their minds, you know, no one likes to think they're bad at their own job. I mean, you don't think that. I don't think that. So doctors would think, okay, well, all the sort of the common conditions, you know, I have that covered. But even the best doctors, I think, are aware that there, you know, there are more than 7,000 known rare diseases with like an infinite number of symptom constellations. And even for the best doctors, even for specialists in the field, it's kind of impossible to have all of that at the top of their mind in when they're making a diagnosis. So so it was sort of an easier sell, I would say, in the early days to doctors also to say, you know, this is something that we developed specifically for rare diseases. And no one would feel attacked because they'd be like, yeah, obviously rare diseases, this is something where this might come in play. But then, you know, as we know, even for more common conditions, unfortunately, the rate of misdiagnosis is not insignificant. And a lot of that has to do with the time pressure and other pressures doctors are under. So the original idea was really to help doctors. We did that for a few years. We worked with family doctors, GPs, both in the UK and in Germany. We worked with two amazing GP professors who were involved with the Royal College of General Practitioners and kind of kept iterating our technology, but we didn't really have a lot of users or a lot of people who were actually using our software. And I sort of grew increasingly frustrated with that because, as you know, my background is more in consumer internet, and we actually worked together a long time ago in the e-commerce space. And my mindset was always, I want to see impact. And for me, impact is both how much positive impact can we make for the individual, but also how many people are we reaching? So because, you know, if we can scale this, then, you know, that then we're doing more good and we're making more of an impact. And therefore, I, even from the early days, I was always pushing to get this in the hands of patients. But it took a few years, and I would have to say, if we had to get we had to sort of get ourselves a bloody nose when trying to get into hospitals and doing all of these things and seeing a lot of the red tape, specifically in Germany, that we're dealing with. And finally, after I think 4 or 5 years, I convinced my co-founders and also my investors to create a patient-facing version. And that was, for me, kind of the turning point, because we, you know, we were, I, as you know, I'm a lawyer by training, so I was still a little bit careful. So I said, okay, well, if we launch this towards patients, it's still all a gray area. There's no medical device regulation yet. This was like 2014, right. 15, something. Right. Let's launch it in New Zealand, because if something goes wrong, at least I'm not going straight to jail. Okay,
it's far enough. Right?
So we launched it there. And it was interesting because, like, with like almost no marketing or anything, it went to number one in the App Store in the medical category within a day.
Is that right?
Yeah, and Australians started asking. They were like, okay, we want to have this too. So this really kind of encouraged us. And we were like, okay, well, let's go and launch it everywhere. It did eventually become...
Hold on. This is an incredible story. I love this. So you, what was the... Just to wind it back a couple of steps. So you started at a time where this entire field was pre any huge amount of insight from regulators, effectively. It wasn't completely unknown, but the medical device regulators hadn't really dug into this space yet of sort of automated symptom checking, clinical decision-making assistance stuff. Is that fair? Okay. And so you decided that you would launch the first consumer version of it in New Zealand. Because it was a small contained market. Let's see what happens. And it went to the App Store number one in a day.
Yeah, and that was in the medical category, which is obviously not the entire App Store. But it was the initial feedback we got was extremely positive. And, you know, small little anecdote. We had a feedback button, and people could send us their feedback. And the very first feedback we ever got on the day we launched it was that someone, a lady, wrote to us and said, I downloaded your app. I will never delete your app again because I had these weird symptoms. And I entered all my symptoms in your app, and your app said I'm pregnant. So I went and I got a pregnancy test, and yes, I'm pregnant. So, you know, amazing.
That's the Ada Health baby.
The very first Ada Health baby. As you know, I got married to my co-founder Claire, there are two more Ada babies.
So just again to kind of dig into it. So when you first built the company, and you were building it to help doctors diagnose things more efficiently, more accurately in whatever disease area, did you even think of it as artificial intelligence at that point? Or were you just building a tool, and how you built it was how you built it?
So I definitely thought of it as artificial intelligence, but it was always a slightly semantic discussion that I had with our actual sort of math experts, our reasoning experts, the actual AI people. And they educated me a little bit. I mean, obviously, there's something called, but clearly we weren't building AGI, no general artificial intelligence. But the way I looked at it, we were supporting, and in places where there wouldn't be a doctor, even to some extent, replacing the task that humans would do in a rather accurate way. So I looked at it from, what's the task that's being done? And also I learned about the difference between sort of broad AI and narrow AI, or some people would call it strong AI, weak AI. You know, we were very specialized in a narrow field, but then not that narrow, because our goal was to really eventually cover all of medicine. Mm-hmm. The way we did this was we actually created our own domain-specific programming language in which we codified state-of-the-art medical knowledge. And we've been doing this now for the last...
So why did you have to create your own language?
So because to get to the level of accuracy that we wanted, it was always clear to us that we wanted to be very much doctor-led and kind of expert-led. So we had to create a way for doctors on our team to be able to express and codify the current state of the art in medicine. And so we created a language that was really easy for young doctors to learn. And then we hired over the years hundreds of young doctors, and we basically trained them, kind of retrained them into medical programmers. So we still have more than 50 doctors on staff full time, who every day refine and expand our medical knowledge base.
Wow.
And behind that are basically probabilistic algorithms. And that's the combination of those things basically constitutes the AI. Obviously, now there are other approaches like large language models, etc., that are also considered AI.
Yeah,
and we're working on some of these things, and it's very exciting. But there are pros and cons to the different types of technologies, and we're quite happy with the path we've chosen because it's white box, it's explainable.
Yeah,
if any
regular listeners to the show will know that this is one of the things that obviously PocDoc is not, and we have elements of applied AI that we use in the process. We're not an AI platform in and of itself, but one of the things that's come up consistently when we've had leaders and clinicians who are in this area is, how is it going to be possible for regulators to deal with black box models? Because in theory, the way the regulations are currently written everywhere, not just the UK or not just Europe, but the US, everywhere, is that theoretically you should not be able to deploy a medical device without having full traceability, auditability of every single item within that device. And that currently is not possible with as far as I understand it, with generative AI and LLMs.
Yeah, fully agreed. I think, it's an amazing technology for sure, but it is not possible. I mean, certain things like hallucinations still happen. I mean, we've all seen the examples where, an AI recommends to pregnant women to smoke several cigarettes a day. it all sounds very plausible, which makes it almost a little more dangerous. What we're going to create and launch is kind of a best of both worlds solution. We went through the entire sort of medical device certification. First, we were class one. Now we're class 2A. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of effort, and we've always taken this extremely seriously. We have a very strong medical studies and patient safety team, actually led by doctors based in the UK. Our team is mostly in the UK and Germany still. Mm-hmm. This for us is non-negotiable, that patient safety comes first.
Well, I think it's a kind of an interesting area, which is, I don't know if you, did you see the Tony Blair Institute published a big thing this week around, obviously focused on the UK market, around how the primary care network, which in general is about 50,000 patients, should be expanded to 250,000 patients. And the shortfall should just be moved off into a telehealth clinical decision-making tool. There wasn't a huge amount of detail around that bit of it, but it was more like, hey, let's just let technology deal with this expanded overflow, which I think is theoretically a good thing, but the actual implementation of that strategy relies on there being a high number of very, very reliable players in that space to be able to deliver that level of clinical professionalism, accuracy, oversight, which isn't necessarily there yet, except for ADA necessarily, because I know there's been some others in the field that took slightly different approaches, which maybe haven't panned out so well. So it's like a difference between speed and clinical accuracy and clinical professionalism. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so we don't really do telehealth ourselves. We're very much focused on the AI part, because telehealth, you still need one doctor for one patient at a time. Mm-hmm. But I think Actually, the combination of something like ADA and something like PocDoc could be extremely powerful in taking burden off the system. And I'd love to talk about that more with you.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. When I talk about telehealth, I actually kind of assume that your model is the new telehealth, if that makes any sense, because that's how I think about it. So like, I think the idea that if we have a doctor capacity issue, then it doesn't really matter whether the doctor's seeing the person in person or the doctor seeing the person on the video, it's still coming from the same pot of doctors. I more view this, maybe telehealth is the wrong word, but more like digital front door, digital triage, clinical decision support making, because that is a way where you could relieve a huge amount of burden from the system, as long as it's done correctly and, you know, accurately and safely.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have been doing a lot of that work for several years now in the US with large health systems. Happy to tell you more about that as well.
Yeah, perfect. So let's jump into that. We have our first commercial break. We'll be back in 2 minutes with my guest for our 100th show, Daniel Nathrath, the CEO and founder of ADA Health. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the second part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Daniel Nathrath, the CEO and co-founder of ADA Health. So Daniel, because you've gone from Germany to the UK, well, you were in New Zealand as well, and now in the US. What's you sort of hinted at it before, that something like an ADA and something like a PocDoc and things like that, that might be one big step forward, but what is your vision of how ADA becomes, I guess, the underpinning of this next sort of revolution or step change improvement in patient health? Or what is your, how if you could wave a magic wand, what would this look like?
I think if you look at the state of healthcare globally, there's already a shortage of millions and millions of health workers. There are various studies about that. You know, we're still quite fortunate in countries like in the UK, like in Germany, like in the US. You still have very qualified doctors and pretty good access, really. I mean, there's always going to be things that can be improved, but there are very large parts of the world where people, might not see a doctor in their entire lifetime because there simply aren't any doctors, or they can't afford a doctor. And so if you think about these situations, if you can suddenly give them something that, is comparable in terms of diagnostic accuracy to a Western trained human doctor and allows them in a very simple and easy to use way, possibly even on a feature phone or a very cheap phone to get their health questions answered. And then, you know, in theory, if you could then, even if you can't see a doctor, if you then had access to a test to either confirm or invalidate the AI's diagnostic assumption, basically you would end up, you know, if it's a test with very high sensitivity and specificity, you end up with something that's as accurate as a Western trained human doctor's diagnosis. And then at least you know what you have and you can think about, okay, how can I take action? Obviously, there's a lot of work to still be done there to then build the infrastructure to also help people. But my vision would be that, you know, wherever you are, whether it's in developing countries or in the US or the UK or Germany, that you actually can manage your entire health from, for instance, your smartphone or other connected devices in a really easy manner, where you have kind of a medical brain that's always with you and that to some extent also passively monitors what's going on with you and that can detect things, help you detect things and interpret things before the $100 problem becomes the $100,000 problem.
Yeah.
And I think there's so much still untapped potential with that. In some cases, you will still need to go and see the doctor. So I don't see that as sort of an isolated, standalone tech bro fantasy where you do everything with your phone or some connected
no
device.
No humans ever.
Exactly. So no one wants that. I think, especially if it's something more serious, you want to see a highly skilled human doctor who then can, you know, again, with the help of various technologies, give you a confirmed diagnosis. So I think one thing that we've been working on a lot is sort of on the one hand, building this and further improving this vision on the tech side, but then how to link it into the system. So part of ADA's business model is working with existing healthcare systems. And we're very fortunate for the past few years, we've been working with probably the most highly regarded and most innovative integrated health system in the US. And so if you can really make this whole patient journey really seamless, and you have this medical brain that doesn't only look at symptoms, but that eventually also takes into account lab data, sensor data, wearables mm-hmm. data, and maybe even at some point a full genome sequencing, which, as you know, is becoming more and more and more affordable. So you could have the full genome sequencing as kind of your baseline, and then you kind of track all the data in the background with no effort to the individual, and you have kind of this... This engine monitor that looks at your personal health engine and gives you hints when it's necessary. I think that would be my vision of the future. And then if you do need to see a doctor, then only the distilled part that's relevant to the doctor gets basically handed over mm-hmm. to the doctor. So the doctor doesn't need to start from a blank sheet of paper, but knows the relevant parts of your history and a current snapshot of where you are with no effort, saves the doctor's time, again, takes burden off the system. If the doctor doesn't have to start taking the patient history and knows nothing about you, if this is already integrated and goes into whatever EHR system they're using, then that helps everyone, because it also prevents information loss between the patient and the doctor. So I think there's so much work to do.
Do you think in a market like the US where the financial incentives are not the same as a country where the system's nationalized, do you think that those financial incentives would still support that type of vision?
Yeah, I think from my personal experience, and as you know,
you live in the United States now.
Yeah, so we moved to the US about 2.5 years ago because most of our partnerships, most of our business is now in North America. And so maybe my view is a little bit biased, but I lived in London for a few years, lived in Berlin for a few years. And trust me, I tried to, you know, try to get innovation both into the NHS and into the world of German health systems and German health insurers.
Right.
I probably, you know, rather go to the dentist every single day than sort of keep trying to do that. I mean, I'm obviously joking. I would still love to support the NHS, and I would love to support people in Germany to get better access to healthcare. And we're doing some work. We're working with like one of Switzerland's largest health insurers. We're working with Portugal's largest health system. But I would say the willingness to A, implement innovation, B, not stifle innovation by almost sort of too suffocating attempts at regulation.
Excessive bureaucracy.
And C, actually pay for innovation. I unfortunately, from a European person's perspective, I have to say all these three boxes are ticked better in the US than in any country in Europe. And it's really unfortunate because, you know, I think the people in Europe deserve better. They deserve, this is a big opportunity. There are amazing healthcare startups coming out of Europe. But what I often see is for them to really achieve scale and become successful, they're almost forced to move to the US because especially in Germany, I can tell you, life as a digital health entrepreneur, they don't make it easy for you.
No, and I think that that's a really interesting take on it, which is that basically for all of the strange financial incentives and criticism about the US healthcare system that I guess is visible in the media and sort of the landscape, actually, as the entrepreneur, it's the single most accessible, most valuable accelerant for your business in the world, yeah, as a health tech business, health tech founder.
Yeah, and then, you know, when you look at the US, it's obviously, it's a huge country, you know, hundreds of millions of people, and but it's like the UK. When I first moved to the UK, I always had the misunderstanding, okay, it's the NHS, so if I convince the health secretary or someone, you know, then we can, yeah, you know, bring innovation to the entire country. And then I learned about trusts and AHSNs and, you know, all this stuff.
All that stuff, yeah.
But similarly, in the US, it's obviously much more complicated and fragmented as well. You have regional health systems, you have some for-profit health systems, you have some non-profit health systems. Our sweet spot traditionally, I think, has been where you have an integrated health system, where the healthcare provider is at the same time also the payer. So very similar, actually, to the NHS. So it should work. Because they have the right incentives. They don't have an incentive to kind of push more expensive procedures onto the patient, but yeah, they want to sort of really achieve the triple aim in healthcare, which is to provide a better patient experience at a lower cost and obviously at optimal outcomes, which is the most important thing. And we've seen that, and I have to say, in all the countries that we've been working with partners, there are always people who are really intrinsically motivated, who are in this field because they want to help patients, they want to make a positive impact. That's the same in the UK, in Germany, in the US, yeah, in Tanzania, wherever we've worked. It's just that, you know, if you want to achieve scale, which you have to, because it's a big effort if you want to,
you got to also think about the investment power law, right? So, like, if you know, in order to build a health tech business that has any requirement for R&D, right, as in one that requires upfront investment to cover a period of time where you're developing a product, moving it through regulation, that's actually a big chunk of money that you need to raise, and those funds are investing because they believe that you could be this multi-billion dollar business, but in order to achieve that, then it sort of defaults you across to the US at some point.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I'm sure there are some companies, you know, like yourself, who've been mostly focused on one market in Europe and still managed to be successful. But yeah, if you know, obviously, if you raise a lot of money,
don't worry, Daniel, we're coming to the US. Don't worry, we'll be there.
As you know, I'm waiting for you. You're always invited, and I think your business, the business that you started, has great potential, and it's actually a funny thing, because, you know, when I first saw that you're now also in healthcare, I was like, wait a second, that's Steve. You know, we're both, I guess, more business, more commercial guys. But then I realized it's actually, there's a parallel that you sort of you married the actual brain of the company, and then I was like, okay, well, this might actually work out.
I think that there's definitely, I think that there's real value in having, what I've learned is working with Kieran, my co-founder, who is one of the scientists. There's three of us, so there's two scientists and then there's me. I don't know whether it was the same for you, but the combination made a huge difference, not just in terms of how quickly we could move, because we were actually working, well, there was always a business person at the table to provide a different point of view. So if scientists don't have a counterpoint, or if business people don't have a counterpoint, things get very wonky when you're trying to build a health technology business that's actually clinically driven. There are lots of examples of how an imbalance at the founder level can send a business off down one. I mean, we can talk about a few of them, but it starts to get very, very, maybe not in day one, but a few years down the pathway, you start to realize that you've sacrificed quite a bit potentially, either in terms of speed to market or in terms of clinical accuracy, depending on whichever one has the, you know, has the whip hand.
100%. I think one thing I've learned over the last 13, 14 years is that if you want to build things the right way, and if you want to, if you want to hopefully reach a stage where you can make a sustainable impact at scale, then you really need the combination of, in my view, three main things. I mean, you need someone with a medical background, you need the commercial person, and then you also need someone to lead the tech side of things.
Yeah.
In a way where all three, you know, you have three different people who provide three different perspectives. What we've seen is some of the larger tech companies 10, 15 years ago, they were like, okay, we're going to revolutionize healthcare. We're just going to move in.
We're going to build out health. Yeah, exactly.
And they were lacking the clinical perspective, and that really didn't work. So, it was hard for me actually in the first few years because, you know, as you know, I'm a commercial guy. I was like, okay, I want to go make, you know, close partnerships and all of that.
Yeah.
And we were just building. And I was like, okay, well, what am I meant to do in the meantime? Right. You know, I just want to. Yeah. But it was good because if you leave the scientists completely to themselves, then they might build the most amazing solution, but if it never reaches anyone, then what's the point, right? So
yeah, exactly. It's like the tree falling in the forest. We have this conversation at PocDoc all the time. So you know, we are a medical device manufacturer at the very core of what we are. And you know, there's this debate that we have around, well, you know, there's no point something remaining in R&D forever.
Yes.
You can continue to iterate. You really could forever. But if it doesn't get into production, if it never reaches a patient, then it's pointless. So
yeah, both things are true, and you have to find the sort of the going in the middle, because the other thing you can't do and you shouldn't do is basically ignore the clinicians and say, I want to move fast and break things and just launch.
No.
If you do this in, like, let's say in online ticketing and you ship the wrong ticket, you know, people get very emotional, they get very angry. But it doesn't, you know, risk their health or their life. But here it would be totally irresponsible. You can't just say, okay, YOLO, we're just going to launch this. And if it tells someone it's a heart attack, you know, it looks like you have shoulder pain, which, you know, is a real example, what happened in some cases. And then you don't want to do that either. But on the other hand, as you say, you can't stay in the lab in the ivory tower forever either. So you have to really find that.
But I don't know about you, but I think that for a clinically driven health business. So there's lots of health businesses that I wouldn't necessarily say are clinically driven. So there's a huge number of businesses sort of, you know, automating patient registration and all that kind of stuff. I wouldn't say they're necessarily clinically driven. If you're clinically driven, I think this debate is one of the key debates that you have, which is how good is good enough? And how do we objectively assess that point so that the clinical team, the technology team, the commercial team are all aligned and it's clinically safe, but it's commercially viable and it's integrated with our technology and it integrates with our partners' technology and all of these things can sort of come together. But I think it's a really interesting debate. And as you say, there's loads of examples of where people didn't do that very well, you know, in the telehealth space, Babylon and a whole bunch of other people there, where that didn't really happen. And then subsequently, it turns out that there was misrepresentations made about their technology and all these other things. And actually, then it was clear that debate was not happening. Or if it was, it was probably being stifled in some way, shape or form.
Yeah, so yeah, I agree. And the one point that I finally used to convince my scientist co-founder to launch is that I said, you know, how are you going to learn if you don't launch? You know, you need to learn. In the long run, you actually do a better service to the patients if you launch it, because that helps you to iterate it and make it better for the next patient. So that's then how we finally got out.
So what I think that touches on, we're going to have to go for our second commercial break now, but that touches on, I think, this idea of how do you create a regulatory environment that enforces some objective standard of safety, of performance, but recognizes that if you prevent anything from launching, nothing ever gets better. I think that's a really difficult question to answer with the space that you and others are in. I think that's a very, very tricky problem. So I don't know, I'll give you the break to come up with your response. So we'll go for a 2-minute break, and then we'll be right back with the final part of this week's show with Daniel Nathras, CEO of Ada, Ada Health. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to the final part of this week's show with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Daniel Nathrath, the CEO and co-founder of Ada Health. So Daniel, just before the break, I posed you a thorny question about how do regulators create an environment that doesn't prevent innovations from launching in this space, but also maintains an objective level of patient safety.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing are slightly different approaches depending on the geography you're from. Like in our space, for instance, I'm a lawyer by training, and the law almost necessarily always trails behind when it comes to innovation. I mean, lawyers they see, okay, what's going on. For a while, they don't understand it because most lawyers are Luddites. And then after a while, they're like, okay, well, maybe we should regulate this. And I'm sure it's done with good intentions. But so in our space, what happened is we launched our app. I got invited by the mayor of Berlin at the time to like a private dinner, and it was like, so great. We have like a healthcare startup. And the same day, I got a letter in the mail from the administration under the mayor, obviously unbeknownst to the mayor, imposing a fine on me for launching an app without sort of asking them first. I was personally, I was ordered to pay, I can't remember, like 10,000 or 20,000 fine. Wow. To the director of the company. So I wrote to the mayor and I said, you got to be kidding me. I'm not coming to your dinner because we're trying to do something good here. And basically you guys are sort of trying to stifle this. Yeah. So, this is just an anecdote, but I would say in our space, the FDA in the US basically looked at this and they said, we're going to practice something called enforcement discretion. We're watching, we want to make sure, basically we look at this space, we will still come after you if we feel like patients being harmed, but we're letting you innovate, we're watching.
And that's amazing. That's a very pragmatic approach.
Yes. Yeah, and in Europe, what happened is basically the lawmakers in the EU decided they were going to use a very similar approach that they had when it came to medical devices that are actually hardware, and they were going to apply it to software, which I understand because that's what they know, and they were like, okay. But then, of course, a lot of things don't really fit, like something that works for hardware won't work like that for software. And so as we were going for this class 2A certification for about, I think it was like a year and a half, we couldn't launch any new features because you're ordered to freeze and you can't do anything new. And at the same time, we were trying to work globally with partners, and they said, can you do this and can you do that? And we're like, well, yes, we can, but we're not allowed to because we were told we have to freeze everything.
Have they changed that? Because that is, so that's the classic design freeze, which works well kind of when it's a hardware product, but even then it's not great, but you can sort of, for some kind of iterative self-learning, developing software, it makes no sense.
Yeah, I agree. And then, of course, if you look at other geographies in Asia, I don't know exactly what the regulation is, but, it's certainly not, you don't get the same level of IP protection that you would have in Europe and in the US. So it's a slightly uneven playing field. And now it gets more interesting because You have the medical device regulation, but since the EU likes to regulate, now you have the AI regulation, and that's
Oh,
going to be
there's a whole
that's a
separate thing.
whole so that's a whole separate thing.
Oh, wow.
And in some cases, some of these rules are actually contradictory to some extent. So
Oh
you
my
have
God.
so you
Really?
under medical device regulation and under data protection rules, you're like re so under data protection rules, I think you're required to delete certain data after a certain amount of time. But under medical device post-market surveillance
Well, not
rules,
allowed to,
you're
yeah.
not allowed to delete it. And then you have the AI regulation. So it's all done with good intention, and I think it's important to protect consumers from snake oil salesmen and all this. So I understand the reasoning behind it, but as a European who's spent time in both geographies, I would encourage European regulators to be vigilant, but to also be careful not to stifle innovation too much.
I think it's really dangerous. Well, it's dangerous on both sides. If you get it wrong either way, but I think one of the biggest risks here, and I would say this because I'm an entrepreneur in the space, but so take that for what it's read. Obviously, I have my own bias, but if you can if there's the US is already the most valuable healthcare market from a financial basis. It already is. And it's already the most accessible, and it's already the most well-funded and well-capitalized and so on and so forth. And if Europe continues to become a harder place to navigate from a regulatory perspective, on top of all of that, it will ultimately harm patients in Europe because it will restrict the amount of innovation that happens massively. It will throttle it massively. And it will basically be left to already established gigantic businesses that don't that move slowly and don't really launch new stuff and don't really do new stuff.
Yeah, you raise a really interesting point. When we first started this, a question I would always get both from potential partners in Europe and also from investors was, but what about liability? What if, someone uses this and, what it comes up with isn't the right suggestion? And I said that's a great question, but what if someone doesn't use it? And then, I think we're getting closer to this tipping point where, at some point in the future, it'll actually be considered malpractice if you don't use AI, because you won't have used something that's that you could have used.
Well, it's getting that way in radiology, isn't it? I think that will be the first one to go. So they've the models that are being used in imaging are good enough now that it is getting to that point where I either now already in some places they're mandated to use the AI first, or it's in the process of being that way for exactly that reason. So the AI is good enough that you have to use it, and then if you haven't used it and made a decision, then you open yourself up to liability.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not aware of I'm not an expert on that particular area, but I think eventually we'll be there. And I think it's an interesting aspect. When we started, or even after we'd already been in the market for several years in Germany, some of these administrators, they clearly had never tried our software, but then they would be like, ah, yeah. It's nice your toy thing there, and it's okay to use it if you have a cold, but for real stuff, no. And I was once at a dinner with someone who was a president of a doctor association in Germany, and I was kind of the guest speaker at the dinner. I talked a little bit about the potential of AI, and he I could see the guy's face was kind of getting a little more upset every minute, and then he when I was done, he said, oh, your app thing, I already know it will never, it will never be as good as a doctor. And I didn't know what kind of doctor he was, but then I found out he was actually a trained radiologist, although I think he hadn't practiced for a long time. So I didn't say anything, but I was thinking, you might be the first one to be hit
You're
by
the first one.
something.
I mean, because the imaging stuff is the first one to go for sure.
Even
That's
though,
gonna
even
be
though I still believe, so it's never been our goal in any way to replace doctors. It's always been our goal to support patients and support doctors, because I do strongly believe that the combination of having a doctor with high empathy, very qualified doctor that uses the best tools available, that's the best thing for the patient. I think, as much as I'm a tech enthusiast, if I or one of my children were to have something really serious, I still want to find the best human specialist, if for nothing else, then because you want this human empathy.
Mm-hmm. And I think that we should be constantly trying to make these processes more efficient. With a static or declining medical workforce, we should be working around how can we maximize the capacity that we have in the system by using technology to remove burden where it makes sense and where it's clinically safe.
I lived in the UK. I was actually friendly with two former health secretaries in the UK. I always talk to them about this. I know you have this thing called NHS 111.
Yeah.
I think, you know, that's still using decades old decision tree algorithms.
Yeah, they run through it in a live, like it's literally they're looking at a spreadsheet.
Basically, you have untrained, medically untrained call handlers who look at these decision trees. No wonder everyone ends up in the A&E, you know?
Yeah.
And we've been...
That's without wishing to go off on a sidetrack. That's okay, but we can't have a business that runs an app that has clinical staff that have verified all of the results and so on and so on and so on. That's not okay, but we can have these gigantic NHS call centers with untrained handlers reading things off of a screen.
Yeah, like, so I'm thinking more about
what you're not being judged on the same. It's not an equal judgment here.
Yeah, that's one thing, but I'm also thinking, well, what's the effect of this? Basically, you have overrun A&Es, and that's not what you want. So the way we work with the largest US health systems, and I predict, you know, by the end of next year or year and a half or so, we will be covering about 10% of the US population with our solution. So you know, we actually work with the health system the UK often looks at as a model for innovation. So what we do is basically people use Ada first, actually in a white labeled version. So you wouldn't know it's Ada, it's fully integrated. They use this first, and then it helps them decide, do I actually need to go see a doctor? And it also helps them decide which doctor to see. I know in the UK, you always go to the GP first. But the idea here is that really, if you have a more intelligent triage system, you could still have calls, and this could support the call handlers as well as the patient herself or himself. And then you would actually take a lot of burden off the system. It would be a better patient experience. So, Steve, I know you're very influential in the UK. Get me in front of the right people, and you know, we will help them improve NHS.
I think it's a great goal. I think it really is. So we've only got a couple of minutes left on the show. So this is the time where I like to try and sort of ask our guests to share some insight and that might be useful to anyone out there listening who's starting their own business or working on different things or anything. So like what are the one or two things that you think people don't realize about starting a business in health? Like the misconceptions.
Yeah. So I think the short answer is how long everything takes. You know, I'm coming from e-commerce and having been in the internet industry for 25 years now. I was used to the lean startup approach, building an MVP, releasing it, gaining, you know, generating data, learning from it, and iterating quickly. Depending on what you're building in healthcare, as we discussed before, you can't really do that. And the other thing we briefly touched upon earlier is also the importance of having the clinician perspective. My wife, Claire, who is a UK-trained doctor and our chief medical officer, she started this initiative in the UK. She founded it called Doctorpreneurs, which is still around.
I didn't know that. That's still a big thing. I didn't know.
Yeah. So she started and she eventually handed it over to some friends who are sort of managing the day to day. But
amazing.
And I think You want, if you're a business person, you want that medical person with you because it's much more complex than you would have thought. It's more complex than, quickly setting up an e-commerce shop to sell pizza or something. And it's a higher responsibility, but it's also much more rewarding because you every day you wake up, you're working for something with a purpose, and that's why I never regretted doing this.
Perfect. What a great way to end the show, our 100th show. So, Daniel, thank you very much for coming on the show. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.